The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
More than 70% of people tell the country is on the wrong track. They say the country is on the wrong track. If it's on the wrong track, that track follows 3.5 years of you being vice president and President Biden being president. That is what they're saying, 79% of them. Why are they saying that? If you're turning the page, you've been in office for 3.5 years.
And Donald Trump has been running for office.
But you've been the person holding the office.
Come on. Madam Vice President. You and I both know what I'm talking about. You and I both know what I'm talking about.
I actually don't. What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is that over the last decade, people have become... But listen.
I actually don't. Hasn't that been what we've all been saying for the past 4 years? I actually don't know what you're talking about. I'll be honest, there are moments, I give them the benefit of the doubt. I try to understand what point could she possibly be trying to make, even if I don't agree with it. And I cannot understand what she's saying. Right there in that moment, Bret Baier saying, I actually don't understand what you're saying. And then her ending that clip with, listen, listen. It reminded me of Joe Biden when everyone was questioning his health and he just says, watch me. Well, we're all watching, we're all listening, and nobody understands, and people are turning away. Remember, 2019, Kamala Harris, she got no votes, and 2024, Kamala Harris got no votes either. How desperate is this campaign to appear on Fox News, of all places? I think Obama, he maybe did one or two. There was the infamous interview with Chris Wallace where he talked about how he never intervened in a DOJ investigation, a flat-out lie. And the Democrat media was talking about this Fox interview as if this is her chance to break through into the Trump ecosystem to try to get that message out. And it was a total disaster. It wasn't Kamala trying to break through. This was an interview of last resort. Let's try to make Kamala look tough. And she was met with a reality check, and not even a very tough one. Bret Baier is not pushing her like he could have. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston, your guest host for today's program. Well, half of it, at least. We are in Ohio celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. So we're pre-recording quite a few segments. I apologize in advance if I'm looking off screen at times. I'm running this by myself and I've got about 3 or 4 screens I've got to manage. So don't think that I'm like Adam Schiff with my eyes and looking all over the place. I'm just trying to keep track of timing and making sure that the recording is still working. And my notes, I also couldn't print them, so they're on a screen. So I apologize for that. Mr. Palmer did the show yesterday. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that one, check that out. And then the second half of today's show will actually be a Bible study segment that Mr. Stephen Fleury recorded in advance before we left for this trip. If you have any comments for the show, as always, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Make sure to watch the stream on Rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. Like and subscribe. We need more subscribers on that channel. So 90%, I think it's over 90% of Kamala Harris's staff as vice president, that's her turnover rate, is 90%. She's always been a train wreck. I mean, there was a reason she didn't win the nomination. She didn't get, I don't even think she made it to Iowa, if I'm remembering correctly. Back in 2019, she was the first to drop out. And I remember when they announced her as the vice presidential nominee along with Biden, I mean, everybody was scratching their heads. And in hindsight, you look at it, even in that moment, you look at it and think, well, they're not trying to win this election. And Biden was hiding in the basement. And then Kamala Harris as the VP, the least popular candidate of all of them running that year. Biden admitted that he wanted Klobuchar. He got along with her better. Biden and Harris, Biden and Obama, they don't get along. There was that clip over the weekend of Biden and Obama at the funeral and Obama just talking down to him, won't even make eye contact with him. Looks like he's had enough time with him, tries to walk away, and Biden again pulls his arm back and Obama rolls his eyes. I mean, no respect even for the fake presidential office. But then again, back to 2020, they announced Kamala Harris as the VP. Who are you winning over with that pick? So California is not a swing state. That's a lost cause. You're not getting anything there. And again, you look back at that and it's, well, if you're planning to steal an election, it doesn't really matter who you pick. I think the same thing about Tim Walz. What are they thinking? Well, they can steal it. It doesn't matter who they're picking. She didn't have the qualifications to even be a politician in San Francisco. We all know how that went. She doesn't have the qualifications to be a prosecutor. We'll talk a little bit about the plagiarism scandal. Didn't have the qualifications to be a U.S. senator, not to be vice president. Not that you need a ton for that one. Certainly not to be president. I mean, this interview is a look at our upside down world. Kamala Harris has been living in this made up world for decades, and she just got a little reality check. Faced with a few hard questions from maybe a little tougher media. Hardly a hostile environment, hardly like the hostile environment that Donald Trump voluntarily walks into. I mean, how did she make it this far? That says a lot about our country, about our Isaiah 3 nation. I wanted to start with just reading this quote from the regime media, their take on Kamala's big Fox interview. This was the big headline on Drudge, which, I mean, is totally meaningless now when they put the bright red letters. Any tiny little thing that's anti-Trump, like Bob Woodard's book, bright red letters on Drudge. And that's when you know, okay, this probably isn't that big of a deal. And then Kamala Harris was cat eats the fox. like she dominated this interview. And then the article that it links to, this is Drudge. Remember how great Drudge used to be? It links to an article from Deadline titled, "In the Belly of the Beast, Kamala Harris Fights to Get a Word in During Inimical Inaugural Fox News Interview." This author says, jumping into the belly of the beast at the conservative cable newser for the first time in her long career, Harris found herself being pilloried by Bear, especially over illegal immigration and border security. At the same time, having been roasted online by the MAGA base in anticipation of softball questions, Bear barely let the VP get a word in during the opening part of the sit-down. Deadline says, it wasn't a good look for Fox, and a gift to Harris, who got to play tough in Trump's media backyard and lean into her rival's mental decline. Raising her voice several times, the VP once again went hard on her default position that Trump is fundamentally unstable and dangerous to have back in office. Not a good look for Fox. That's their take. I mean, how many hostile interviews has President Trump walked into? I just saw last night he did that town hall with Univision. I mean, that's not friendly media for him. Fox, you could argue, is hardly friendly media for him. And here's Kamala Harris finally goes into a somewhat tough interview. And she's not yelling to make a point. She's not yelling to stand her ground. She's yelling because she's getting upset. They have a short fuse and they're not used to being challenged. Deadline says, as Bear played largely to the MAGA base and his core viewership, the veteran anchor appeared largely out of his depth. Challenged on his questions and wanting to flex his own muscles, Bear ended up fumbling his line of questioning and losing control of the interview to the well-prepped VP as he got caught up in centering over and over on culture war issues and Joe Biden's mental acuity. As he got caught up centering over those issues that are the most important issues to voters, and for them to act like, well, we're just moving on from Joe Biden. Brett Baer brings that up I mean, that exposes all of them. June 27th or June 28th, I don't remember which day, it was a Thursday. That exposed all of them because, like that, they all flipped. For 4 years, it was, this man is at the top of his game. And then we all saw the train wreck. We'd been seeing train wrecks for years. While they tell you, don't believe your lying eyes, he's just fine. And then they all flip. Kamala, in this interview, I mean, she's supposed to be campaigning. Obviously, there's going to be knocking the opponent. But she can't sell herself. She can't sell anything good about her campaign. Over and over, it's Trump derangement syndrome. It is but Trump. Even when she's asked about families who have had children murdered by illegal immigrants, that Biden and Kamala's policies are directly responsible for. I mean, notice how much she just can't stop talking about Donald Trump. This is clip one.
And here's the bottom line. He has repeated it many times. And you and I both know that. And you and I both know that he has talked about turning the American military on the American people. He has talked about going after people who are engaged in peaceful protest. He has talked about locking people up because they disagree with him. This is a democracy. And in a democracy, the president of the United States, in the United States of America, should be willing to be able to handle criticism without saying he'd lock people up for doing it. And this is what is at stake, which is why you have someone like the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying what Mark Milley has said about Donald Trump being a threat to the United States of America.
That's all. And she just made that stuff up. She says it like we all know it. Play the quote of Donald Trump saying those things. Meanwhile, you've got Democrats rounding up Americans who were on, some of them didn't even go into the Capitol, just around that building in the vicinity, didn't even know they were trespassing, being rounded up and locked up. Steve Bannon, he's supposed to get out of prison, I think, the day before the election. Peter Navarro, he was in jail. And we talked to Dinesh D'Souza, he went to jail. I mean, who's imprisoning their political opponent? Donald Trump could have. I mean, they chanted, lock her up, and then he wins the election, and he doesn't do it. A lot of people say he should be a lot tougher, but she's making a lot of that stuff up. She can't quote it. Then she gets mad at Bret Baier later because he plays a clip, and she says, you didn't play that in its entirety. Which is what they do with all of his clips anyway. She was getting really worked up there, getting mad. She wasn't, you know, like the regime media said, she wasn't being tough in that moment. She was getting upset. Here's another clip, clip two.
Jocelyn Nungeri, Rachel Morin, Lakin Riley, they are young women who were brutally assaulted and killed by some of the men who were released at the beginning of the administration, well before a negotiated bipartisan bill. Former President Clinton actually referred to Lakin Riley Sunday, campaigning for you in Georgia, saying if those men had been properly vetted, Lakin Riley probably would not have been killed. So if it wouldn't have happened, this is well before any negotiation. This is well before Donald Trump got involved in the politics. This is a specific policy decision by your administration to release these men into the country. So what I'm saying to you, do you owe those families an apology?
Let me just say, first of all, those are tragic cases. There's no question about that. There is no question about that. And I can't imagine the pain that the families of those victims have experienced for a loss that should not have occurred. So that is true. It is also true that if a border security had actually been passed 9 months ago, it would be 9 months that we would have had more border agents at the border, more support for the folks who are working around the clock trying to hold it all together.
Madam Vice President.
To ensure that no future harm would occur. And this election in 20 days will determine whether we have a president of the United States who actually cares more about fixing a problem, even if it is not to their political advantage in an election, because there was a solution, Brett.
Madam Vice President, it was a policy decision in the early part of your administration.
Remember how they came into office rescinding those 90 orders that Trump had to secure the border? And then they turn around and they blame Congress because they didn't, because Republicans stood up to this bill that, sure, you could argue it would have helped, though getting more judges and a few more border security agents, of course that would help a little bit, but what would really help is enforcing the law. And they wanted to pass that, and they never say that, along with all of this other spending pork, their pet projects. Hundreds of billions of dollars. So they pick that little detail and say, oh, they're against securing the border. Well, you can be for the border, but against the 9 other things that are in that bill and decide not to vote for it. Again, though, she's asked about these young people who were murdered by people who came in the country illegally as a direct result of her administration's policies. And what does she say? Well, 9 months ago, Donald Trump could have solved this problem. Imagine saying that. Solved this problem entirely, and he just didn't want to do it. She hardly acknowledges those families. When they don't want to fix something, they blame Congress. And then you think about, well, what about what Obama said when he wanted to get something done? If Congress isn't going to do it, I've got a pen and a phone. They don't want to solve that problem. They know how to do it. They undid what Trump did, and now it looks bad. Clip 3.
Because there was a solution, Brett.
Madam Vice President, it was a policy decision in the early part of your administration. I will let one of the mothers talk about it. Take a listen.
Because of the Biden-Harris administration open border policies catch and release, they were enrolled in the Alternatives to Detention program. This meant that they were released into the United States. It was not even a full 3 weeks later that they would take my daughter Jocelyn Nungaray's life. I believe the Biden-Harris administration open border policies are responsible for the death of my daughter.
That's the early days. So do you owe them an apology is what I'm saying.
I will tell you that I am so sorry for her loss. I'm so sorry for her loss. Sincerely. But let's talk about what is happening right now with an individual who does not want to participate in solutions. Let's talk about that as well.
A lot of people said that that is the clip that would bury her. I mean, she hardly would acknowledge that mother whose little girl was raped and murdered, and then just says, but let's talk about Donald Trump. It's insulting. And then for them to say, we have a solution, but they won't do it. And then notice how she's finally talking about her visit to the border after years of not visit, after years of attacking border agents. Remember how they sued those border agents when they were pictured with they were on the horses and they had to whip the horses, and there was the whole regime media narrative that they were whipping the migrants as they came across the border. They didn't have the backs of those border security agents. They were investigating them. I mean, at every opportunity they had, they were undermining border security. There's the footage of the barbed wire fencing and all of the migrants standing on the other side, and the Kamala Harris administration dispatching the forklifts to go lift the barbed wire that Abbott had put in place so that the migrants could flood in. Not at a port of entry, just across a random spot of border. It's a lawless administration. Here's clip 4.
I was just down at the border talking with border agents, and they will tell you, and I'm sure you probably, I know you investigate and you are a serious journalist. They will tell you, we need more judges. We need to process those cases faster. We need the support for those cases that should be prosecuted. They need more resources, and Congress ultimately is the only place that that's going to get fixed, Brett. Well, that's how this system works.
That's the premise of this question. There were 90-plus executive orders that were rescinded in the first days. Many of those were Trump border policies. I'm not going to stay here because there's other things to talk about, but you frequently talk to the Border Patrol Union for support of that bipartisan bill, and they did. They supported it. But they also just endorsed Donald Trump and said, you've been, quote, a failure with border security. Why do you think they said that?
I think they're frustrated, and I get it. They want support.
I get it. No, she doesn't. She knows what she's doing. I mean, for her to say, look, I've been to the border. I'm talking to them. And she's finally compelled to visit the border. The borders are, who never visited the border. Now she's in the middle of a campaign, knows how important this issue is to voters. Remember the interview? That was another friendly interview. I think that was Lester Holt on NBC. And she, what do you mean? I haven't been to the border. Well, I also haven't been to Europe. Finally gets down there and then says, I've talked to these people. I know them. You know the first thing they say? They want more judges. I really doubt that's what those agents are saying. I bet a lot of them are saying, we want to enforce the rules. We want to enforce the laws that we know we're allowed to, that you're telling us not to. I mean, there's so many things. It's such an easy problem to solve. But this country is being led by a regime that is hostile to this country, that wants to destroy it. Clip 5.
The significance of that.
You call Donald Trump, he's misguided. You say now
he's unstable. He is unstable, but
he's not well. You say he's mentally not stable.
He's not stable.
Let me ask you this. You told many interviewers that Joe Biden was on his game, that ran around circles on his staff. When did you first notice that President Biden's mental faculties appeared diminished?
Joe Biden, I have watched from the Oval Office to the Situation Room. And he has the judgment and the experience to do exactly what he has done in making very important decisions on behalf of the American people. Joe Biden is not on the ballot.
I understand.
And Donald Trump, after George Clooney said within a few minutes of talking to President Biden at a fundraiser
that he thought this was not the same Joe Biden that we saw on the debate stage.
Donald Trump is on the ballot.
I understand. You met with him at least once a week for 3.5 years. You didn't have any concerns?
I think the American people have a concern about Donald Trump.
TDS, Trump derangement syndrome. She can't get over it. I mean, for her to even say Biden's not on the ballot, that question didn't have anything to do with Joe Biden. That question had everything to do with Kamala Harris lying about Joe Biden's state of mind for 4 years. And then for her to get up there and brag about Donald Trump won't release his health records. Well, how can anybody trust you? I mean, it's so obvious. She couldn't get out of that one. She was stuck in that one. But every question, but Trump. And a lot of people are saying, well, you're campaigning. You have to sell yourself. What are you for? Well, I'm not Donald Trump. Okay, well, that boulder over there also isn't Donald Trump. Let's nominate that. What are you? But Trump. Someone put together a montage like we'd done the other day with Barack Obama, how he couldn't stop talking about Trump. And then there was Adam Schiff a week or two before that. Couldn't talk about what they wanted to do for the people of California. Just Donald Trump. Someone made this for Kamala Harris. I couldn't get a version of it without the dancing Donald Trump on screen. So if you're watching, you can enjoy that little bit in the corner. This is clip 7.
Donald Trump.
Let's go back to Donald Trump. The campaign is so bad. It's falling apart because all they can talk about is Trump. And the great part about that is we have 4 years of Trump and we have 4 years of Biden. It's a pretty simple choice. And her campaign is desperate. Going on that interview with Fox, that's a desperation move. Let's go try to look tough. Who are they selling that to? The authors at Deadline I mean, there's a few hundred people that really buy that stuff, and they're trying to sell it to their base. I don't have a lot of time to get into these things. There was this, I would call it another scandal about Kamala's plagiarism, and the New York Times quoted this guy who said, well, it's not really that big of a deal. And then that guy came out later and said, well, they didn't present me, when they asked me, I'd only seen a couple passages. And then he says, when I actually looked at everything, when they presented me the full, they're calling it a dossier, it actually was worse than it originally appeared. So the New York Times just jumps out in front of that, tries to get his take right away. And this was an expert in plagiarism. And then he comes out and says, well, that's actually a bit worse. And then there was a longer article here about Kamala's campaign in Pennsylvania. And all of these insiders speaking to Politico, talking about how nothing's organized here, it's a huge mess, we're worried we're going to lose a lot of the suburbs in Philadelphia, which is what the regime said is what pushed Biden over the edge. So things are not looking good for the Harris campaign. And what amazes me is this is just 2 months removed from some of the most intense regime media swooning you've ever seen. All of the, she brought joy back. We have joy again, they were saying. They wanted so badly for that to be Obama 2008. And look at where it is in less than 2 months. This is always an interesting time of the year. God's people are keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, and that pictures a perfect world. That pictures the world tomorrow. And then it's always just before election season or when elections take place in the United States. And you get all of these reminders every day of the failure of man's system. And God contrasts that with how a perfect world is going to operate. I don't have time to get into that on today's show. Mr. Stephen Fleury touches on it in the Bible study, and I'm sure it'll come up in other programs this week. That's unfortunately all I have time for this first half. The second half will be a Bible study that Mr. Stephen Fleury pre-recorded. Again, if you have any comments for the show, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel on Rumble.com/TrumpetDaily. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you again Monday.
The Apostle John wrote his gospel and his epistles quite a few years after the ministry and the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And over that time, he had a lot of time to think about just how special it was to learn at the feet of God's own Son and to actually be in the presence of God, God in the flesh. He writes in 1 John 1 and verse 1, this is John's epistle, it says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled of the word of life, it says there. He was looking back and he really did have time to meditate on all of those moments that he had been with Jesus Christ, seeing him, handling him, as it says there, touching him, hearing him, watching him, following him, looking at his perfect example. I mean, he really knew Christ. He got to know Jesus Christ by living with him for every day, or I guess it would be nearly every day, for 3.5 years. He saw it all. He fellowshipped with God's Son. My father wrote this in The Value of a God Family Education. It says, having teachers who teach and build on what Mr. Armstrong, that's Herbert W. Armstrong, what Mr. Armstrong taught is precious. We should want to take advantage of that so God can use us in amazing ways. It says we must plunge into God's family. And that's really what John is discussing in 1 John 1. He was immersed into the family of God for those 3.5 years. And in the spiritual sense, it continued even after Christ's resurrection. It says being immersed or plunging into the family of God is the only thing that will give us a solid education. And this is because God is a family. And if you haven't yet proven that, please request our book, Mr. Armstrong's book, Mystery of the Ages. It'll teach from the Bible what God reveals about his awesome purpose and plan. He has another book that goes by the title, The Incredible Human Potential. There's a reason God brought us into existence. There's a purpose being worked out here below. It does require some study, but it's a fascinating, exciting, thrilling study. The 800 number, if you want to request Mystery of the Ages, it's 1-866-930-3024. Verse 2, here in 1 John, it says, "For the life was manifested, and we have seen it, and bear witness, and show unto you that eternal life, which was with the Father, and was manifested unto us." Look, we saw him. We learned from him. We want you now, you brethren reading this epistle, we want you to have that same intimate fellowship with God the Father and Christ the Son. Fellowship with the God family. That is true education. Fellowshipping with God. Fellowshipping with God's Son, looking to Jesus Christ as your Lord and Master, following in His steps, 1 Peter 2:21, Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2, that's the verse that talks about looking to Jesus Christ and that perfect example. I've put together a few points. We'll just go over these points in the next mini programs. They're points on how Jesus Christ, the Master, the teacher, how he taught his disciples, what made him so effective. Nicodemus in John 3 came to him in the middle of the night, but he still acknowledged that you're a teacher who came from God. Now, if it's God's teacher, then you're going to receive the truth. There's not going to be any bias connected to it. There's not going to be any deceit. There's not going to be any human reasoning. It's going to be from God. The first point that I have is that Jesus Christ showed the disciples how to obey and serve God. He wasn't just a hearer only. He was a doer. And so he would teach. He would discuss. He would explain. You've got the Sermon on the Mount. You've got all the parables. And then he'd go off with the disciples and explain the meaning. You've got the Passover ceremony message from John 13 to John 17. There was lots of classroom instruction. But more important than that, Jesus showed them. He showed them how to live. Notice John 14. We need a perfect example to look to. Example is crucially important when it comes to true education. John 14:6, Jesus said unto him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man can come unto the Father but by me." So we have to look to Jesus Christ. He is the way. That doesn't mean we ignore the Father by any means. He's the head of the family. He's at the center of the family. But he sent his Son to show us the way, to show us how to get to the Father. Jesus said himself in John 1:18, I came to declare the Father. I was right in his bosom. I saw him. I handled him. I heard him. And he came to reveal the Father. Doubting Thomas, remember, said, just, you know, before Christ left, just show us the Father. And Christ was, he was just kind of beside himself at that point. Look, how long have I've been with you all this time and you still don't know that if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I've shown you the God family. I've shown you godly righteousness. It's been on display. In Mystery of the Ages, this is the book I just mentioned. If you want a free copy, again, call that 800 number. All of our literature, it's offered without cost, without obligation. It says in Mystery of the Ages, the loner, the individual Christian who wants to climb up into the kingdom some other way than by Christ and his way through his church, is not being trained in Christ's manner of training to rule and reign with Christ in his kingdom. We can't just go into the kingdom of God our own way, just stubbornly refusing to heed the commands of God. We can't drift into the kingdom our own way. We can't go in through the back door. Jesus Christ is the way. And so we have to look to him. We have to follow that perfect example. We have to obey God's perfect and holy and just laws. Look at Romans 7 and verse 12 sometime. Why so much hostility toward God and his laws, even in the world of traditional Christianity? Why? Why do they try so hard to distort scriptures in order to say that God's law was somehow done away with, that Christ did it all for us? Christ showed us the way. That's what made him such an effective teacher, master. He showed us how to do it. He came down here in the flesh, and he said, look, there's no other way except through me. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. Listen to this quote from The Last Hour. This is my father's book now. The Last Hour says, if we have inappropriate thoughts or attitudes toward God's government or toward a decision that has been made, we must know the Spirit. It says, when we watch television or go to a movie or watch sports, we must know the Spirit. We must think as if Christ is sitting right there with us. It says, is Jesus Christ really coming in the flesh through you? It says, in everything you do? If so, he revolutionizes your life. Christ wants to revolutionize our lives, and he will if we're willing, if we let him in, if we let him lead, if we submit to his authority, if we look to Christ. Verse 7, Jesus said unto him, this is verse 6 again, we're still in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It says, no man comes unto the Father but by me. You see, we have to go through Christ. And then verse 7 says, if you had known me, you should have known my Father also, and from henceforth you know him and have seen him. See, becoming a friend or a companion of Jesus Christ, it draws us close to the Father because those two are one. They're one. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The God and the Word were inseparable, perfectly unified, overflowing with love and joy and all those fruits of the Spirit there in Galatians 5. Verse 8, Philip said unto him, Lord, show us the Father. This is the section I mentioned earlier. And it suffices us. And Jesus said to him, have I been so long time with you, and yet have you not known me, Philip? He that has seen me has seen the Father. And how say you then, show us the Father? I mean, here's one of the more profound verses in all the Bible. Jesus Christ came to demonstrate God's perfect way of life. It was on full display. And after the disciples, in the case of John anyway, in writing about it much later, I mean, he just couldn't believe it. I was actually dwelling with God in the flesh. That's incredible. Verse 10 says, believe you that I am in the Father, and the Father in me? The words that I speak unto you, I speak not of myself, but the Father that dwells in me. He doeth the works. He does the works. He does it through me. He does it in me. And I'm here to show you how to do the same. This is why Christ just poured out his heart to God in prayer. This is why he spent, even though he had a lot of crowds to navigate his way through, I mean, he spent a lot of time in solitude, drawing near to God, receiving power from God, because he knew he couldn't make one mistake. He had to live a perfect life, perfectly obedient. Verse 11, it says, "Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the very works' sake." You see, you can look at the fruits. You could have looked at the fruits of Christ's life in the first century and seen the Father. And that's what he was telling Thomas. Look, if you've seen me, you've seen God. This is how God lives. Jesus, I mean, among other things, first and foremost, he was a follower. It's easy to look at him and his ministry and think that he was, you know, the big shot leader, and he was a leader. But he didn't lead like you see in the world today. It wasn't selfish. It wasn't for his own gain. He wasn't trying to amass a fortune or build an empire even. I mean, that's coming in God's kingdom. But he was a servant. That's the point. He was serving God. He was following God, following that perfect example in heaven. And then, as Peter wrote in 1 Peter 2, now you follow Christ. A big game of follow the leader, as I often say to the students. Follow Christ. Follow his example. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, follow me as I follow Christ. So you've got God the Father, you've got Christ, you've got Paul following Christ, and then he says to the brethren, now follow me, follow my example. The example is so important. We need to hear it, we need to see it, and we need to do it. The second reason that Jesus was such an effective teacher is that he always pointed students or disciples to his own example. This kind of overlaps with the first point. But he was constantly telling them, now look, just do what I've been doing. Do what I do. John 1 and verse 18, I paraphrased this earlier as well. It says, no man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. So Christ had for all eternity this closest and most intimate relationship with the Father, and that's where the Father wants for us to be. It says, this is in the God Family Vision, God wants you in his bosom to have the same relationship that he and Christ have. Jesus Christ set an example showing us how to have that relationship with our Father. It says, you've never seen or heard about another example like Christ, and you will never see another one like it. It says God and Jesus Christ are not just about words. Christ came to the earth and he lived God's way. He demonstrated how it works. He demonstrated it. He showed us, as I said with the first point, he showed us how to serve and obey God. He constantly pointed to his own example, 1 John 2 and verse 5. Let's read this again from the Apostle John. It says, but whoso keeps his word, in him verily is the love of God perfected. Hereby know we that we are in him. Verse 6 says, he that says he abides in him ought himself also so to walk, even as he walked. I mean, if we're gonna be out there saying, yeah, I'm a follower of God, well, we've got to produce. God's looking at the fruits. If we can't get along with our neighbor, our brother, well, that reflects on our relationship with God. It says that here in John's epistle. My father writes in the last hour, he says, we are to walk even as he walked. You need to ponder that statement until it's indelibly etched into your mind, walking like the Messiah. My father says, it is not good enough to keep 9 out of the 10 commandments, that will put us into the lake of fire. It says Christ kept all of the commandments perfectly. That must be our goal, perfection. That's Matthew 5:48. It's biblical. Mr. Armstrong used to say, you know, don't listen to the preachers of this world that say it's impossible to obey God's laws. Yes, we are flawed. Yes, we trip up. Yes, we commit sins. Yes, we need daily cleansing through prayer by the Spirit of God. But don't you believe the preachers that would say it's impossible to keep God's laws, so why bother? That's why the world is the way that it is today. This world needs the purity of God's law and truth, God's teachings, God's government. It needs God's family. That's what solves the problems of this world. Matthew 16 and verse 24 says, "Then said Jesus unto his disciples, If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." You've got to follow me. You've got to follow my example. You've got to deny yourself. You've got to be willing to forsake your ways, to give up this world and the ways of this world. Most people aren't willing to do that. And that's why you have a lot of hearers in the world today that love to hear the message. Read the last few verses of Ezekiel 33 sometime. They love the message of God. I mean, they think it's like a pleasant song. They like to hear it, but they won't do it. That's what Ezekiel the prophet said. Notice 1 Peter 2 and verse 17. I think I paraphrased one of the verses in here as well. I'm getting ahead of myself, evidently. 1 Peter 2:17, it says, "Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." It says, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward." I mean, learn. Peter's writing this at a time when, you know, there was a despicable tyrant heading up the Roman Empire, Nero. Honor the king. Honor that office. Even if the boss is froward, learn the principle of submission. Learn the principle of God's government. Support it. Get behind it. Follow it. I mean, this is a principle that runs through the Bible, cover to cover. Follow, deny self. Take up your cross and follow me. Follow my steps. Follow my example. Verse 19 says, "For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully." I mean, Christ did that. He suffered wrongfully. He didn't deserve what punishment the Romans and the Jews were carrying out against him. It says in verse 21, "For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps." We've been called to follow the example of Jesus Christ. Christ was totally subjected to the Father's will. He subjected himself to God's will in all things. We can't follow our own standard or our own traditions. Jesus, I mean, he corrected the scribes and the Pharisees for doing away with God's law so that they could keep their carnal traditions. They were more interested in their man-made traditions than they were in God's holy law. God says, don't do that. Verse 22, it says, "Who did no sin." Again, look at this memory verse, verse 21, following his steps. But you read the verses around it. It's all in the context of suffering wrongfully. "I've done it," Christ said. You've got to be willing to give up that old man. That's a painful experience. To use God's law and his Spirit to cut away that carnal nature, like Hebrews 4 brings out. Speaking of Christ here in verse 22, it says, "Who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but he committed himself to him that judges righteously." He committed himself to God. My father wrote in the Royal Vision magazine a few months ago, It's a great article on the desires of your heart. He says, that's what God wants us to do, to commit yourself into your Father's hands. It says, if you do, the Father will give you the desires of your heart. He can hardly wait to do so. Committed himself, Jesus did, in the margin of the King James, it says, his cause. In other words, he committed his cause, his interests and desires, his entire life to God. He was a servant of God. And Jesus said in Matthew 20, he was talking to the disciples saying, now, if you want an elevated position in the coming kingdom, you've got to be more than a servant. You've got to be a slave. You've got to develop a slave-like mentality and just get self completely out of the way and let it be God in you. Let God exalt you. Let God empower you. Let God strengthen you. Verse 25, it says, for you were sheep, you were as sheep going astray, but are now returned unto the shepherd and bishop of your souls. You see, before coming into God's family, God's church, I mean, we were just wandering around doing our own thing. That's the way of this world. Every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. But now we've returned to the fold. We've returned to the shepherd. The Lord is our shepherd, our guide. And we look to him. It says in Isaiah 53 and verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. We've all been going our own way. In Matthew 9, Jesus, when he saw the multitudes, he was mournful because they didn't have a shepherd to show them, to teach them. The disciples, they knew that this was their master, this was their teacher, and they looked to Christ. And when he was gone, their hearts burned within them. John wrote, as you heard earlier, he wrote many years later, and he said, look, I was there. I received it. I heard it. I touched him. I spent so much time with him. Notice John 5 and verse 19. It says in verse 19, then answered Jesus and said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father do. It says, for what things soever he does, these also doeth the Son likewise. So again, Christ was a follower. He followed God. He didn't come trying to be all original. Now, he was the most powerful and persuasive teacher to ever walk this earth. But he looked to God. That's what kept him perfect. That's what made him that perfect sacrifice. A lamb slain from the foundation of the world, it says in the book of Revelation. A perfect lamb sacrifice. Notice what he says in verse 30. I can of my own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father, which has sent me. He sought the Father's will from start to finish, even right there at the end when he was praying at Gethsemane, asking God if this cup could pass from him. But he said in every instance, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Whatever your will is. And I mean, he knew. He knew he had to die. He knew he had to be crucified. He had to pray his way through it. He needed power from God. John 8, notice verse 28, it says, then said Jesus unto them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall you know that I am he, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father has taught me. I speak these things. I'm not here doing anything of myself. I mean, this is all about glorifying and honoring God. I mean, the very first thing he told the disciples, they came and said, teach us how to pray like you pray. All right, do it like this. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. honor God, revere God, and then pray for his kingdom. And it all revolves around God and God's kingdom. It always will. As I say, the idea is to get yourself out of the way. My father says here about that verse, John 8:28, what a precious scripture. This all-powerful God said, I do nothing of myself, and whatsoever my father taught me, that's what I teach you. No person on this earth has ever come close to that example of humility. Throughout his physical life, Christ always remembered why he was there. From the beginning, the master plan was that I come down to this earth not to do my own will, but my Father's will. If you keep reading here in John 8, look at verse 29. It says, and he that sent me is with me. The Father has not left me alone, for I do always those things that please him. So that was Christ's overarching goal in all that he did. He wanted to please the Father. He wanted to carry out the Father's will. As I say, Jesus was a follower of God. And true disciples of Jesus Christ are followers of Christ. As he follows God, that's God's family. That's the family that God is inviting us into. Well, that's all we have time for on today's show, the fastest moving hour in broadcasting. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again next week.